You're in the right room. This is The Importance of Adventure. Yay! And this will be the last session for today, as I understand, and I don't want to get in the way. So we have John Houston, and you're going to start off our panel and go down the line.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is John Houston. I do polar expeditions. When I was a little boy in the Chicago suburbs, I was a small boy, I begged my mom to read me the Kon-Tiki story over and over and over. I could not get enough of it. And later on in childhood, I desperately wanted to be Indiana Jones. I actually dug up the backyard trying to be Indiana Jones. I watched the Discovery Channel. I was just so interested in faraway places and being a bit out of touch with normal society. And there's just something in me that was like sparked and excited about all that. I couldn't really put my finger on what it was. It may have been adventure, but I was just so excited about all that. According to this dictionary here on my iPhone, I'm going to read you three definitions for adventure. An exciting or very unusual experience. Number two, participation in exciting undertakings or enterprises. Yeah, I hear the feedback. Yeah. Am I too close here? Is that better? Yeah, can you still hear me?
They need to turn down the gain. You get up close. That's the solution.
He's a sound man.
I was here this morning.
All right.
And we don't have a sound man in the room.
Well, so I'll just do the best I can, and hopefully it'll get better. And number three, a bold, usually risky undertaking, hazardous action of an uncertain outcome. I like that last phrase, uncertain outcome. For some reason, these adventurous stories to me just were a big inspiration. And I liked the worldliness of it. I liked the small teams. And these people seem to be having a hell of a lot of fun at the same time. I got into polar expeditions after working at Outward Bound for a long time. Outward Bound is a wilderness education and leadership school, and it more or less puts people age 13 on up on small expedition adventures where they can learn about themselves and improve their leadership skills, teamwork skills, and maybe choose to make some positive changes in their life. And while working for Outward Bound, I fell in love with historic polar expedition stories. And one of the ones that most captivated me was Roald Amundsen's 1911 expedition to the South Pole. Early polar explorers were the astronauts of their time. The way they solved problems and led their teams was so, so interesting to me. Early polar explorers basically sailed their ships off the map of the world and parked them there, or were dropped off for a period of years with zero communication to the outside world. And they filled in the map. They learned about new places that Western civilization had never known about, and then they went home and told these fantastic stories. And these stories were captivating to me. I used them as leadership curriculum for Outward Bound courses. Amundsen liked to say that, hey, he's a Norwegian guy, so the whole country is more or less very understated, humble people. And Amundsen liked to say, adventure is basically bad planning. So Amundsen took planning very, very seriously. I like to say that preparation and planning are the expedition. As a modern adventurer or explorer, I take that very seriously. Because I feel like I have a responsibility to my family, to my teammates, sponsors, everybody watching these expeditions, school children, to go in as prepared as possible and hold ourselves accountable for success out there. I think one of my most favorite times on expeditions is when things go wrong. I like it. We're out there with limited resources, and we have to solve those puzzles. And to me, those creative times when the outcome is uncertain or that next few steps are unknown are so captivating to me. Like, we have to figure it out, and we are tapped into the creative, optimistic sides of our brains to do that. And that's one of the sparks that keeps me doing what I'm doing. I love being out in remote areas of the world, North Pole area, South Pole, far Arctic Canada. But I love working with teams that are on the edge and have to sort it out. I have two values that I've gleaned from Amundsen and also from Ernest Shackleton, and that's to go into adventure with humility, because things never go according to plan. And when working in nature or just extreme circumstances, I'm always going to have to adapt. Our teams are going to have to change along the way, and there are so many things that we cannot control out there, and we have to have a high degree of being comfortable with that lack of control. And also optimism. Being able to stay positive, maintain a sense of humor, and have fun, even though the circumstances may seem dire or the outcomes very uncertain. And I think that the sense of mission and that sense of the team relationship are more important than my own ego and other people's egos on the team has moved us past some improbable circumstances. Well, I'll leave it there, and we'll tell more adventure stories as we move along here.
Thank you. Eric Lindstrom's next, so why don't you set yourself up?
Sure, thanks very much. My name's Eric Lindstrom. I'm an oceanography program scientist at NASA headquarters. I trained as a seagoing oceanographer back in the late 70s, early 80s, and then moved off to Australia after I got my PhD and took ships to sea, studying the circulation around Papua New Guinea, naming new ocean currents and visiting all sorts of islands across the Pacific. I feel like a very lucky person. Who else has a job that sends them to Tahiti five times, you know, for work? So there's a lot of wonderful islands around the Pacific and wonderful people. And I guess like John, the thing about spending years of my life out on these small research vessels is working with a team, and you're isolated for a month or 6 weeks, and if anything goes wrong, you have to deal with it with the resources on the ship and try and make do. And this idea of preparation is all-encompassing. You've got to make sure that you've got all the stuff that you're going to need there. And those kind of skills carry over to the world I'm in now. I got beamed up to work at NASA because they needed somebody who touched seawater to lead their oceanography program. You wouldn't be surprised to find that there are a lot of people who call themselves oceanographers at NASA who've never touched seawater. Go figure. So we have a nice marriage where I motivate them about the ocean and they train me in satellite technology. And so we got a good partnership going there now for 20 years. But organizing people in Washington, organizing people within a field of risks is the same as an expedition. In Washington, I do the same thing. I learned it at sea, and I just apply the same things in D.C. And it works out pretty well. You know, you got to get along with all your team members, and if you don't want to let any bad karma kind of grow up in the team, and you figure things out, and we do that amongst the agencies. And it takes a village to do oceanography. It's not just the National Science Foundation or not just NOAA. It's got to be NASA. We try and do it all together. I have NASA going to sea now, and I have NSF funding space analysis of satellite data, and these things didn't happen before. So I'm declaring victory here on getting the team going. Some of my adventures that I recall the most, some I can't say here because I don't think they're politically correct, but I think Michelle may talk me into later. We're collaborating on
don't
this.
Don't hold back.
Yeah. Being out in the Southern Ocean when the winds build up to 80 knots and you get 14-meter seas, it's terrifying, absolutely terrifying to be on a small ship climbing up these mountainous waves, and then a whole ship, 150-foot ship, just shoots out the top like a surfboard and then plops down on the other side, and your propellers are whizzing in the air and all, and you go, whoa, get me out of here. So, yeah, those are the kinds of things. And then there's those wonderful days where you visit Kapinga Morangi on the equator in the tropical Pacific, and they get one small boat there every month, you know, and there's people living just on wood platforms, open air, with a little thatched roof and a pig tied up to one corner and a dog on another and a one-room schoolhouse, and life seems idyllic.
You know, how could it get any better than this? So these are adventures. They don't all have to be scary, but you fill your life with these things, and you're much richer for it. So the importance of adventure for everybody, I think, is we're all craving it. This morning in the panel on the human desire for narrative, we talked about how important it is for all of the adventurers to tell their stories, and we live through them. This sort of vicarious experience of adventure is almost an adventure itself. We internalize their adventures in our emotional response to it. And so you don't have to risk your life. You can let John risk his. And there's a deep emotional connection of humans to the story, and adventure is a story that we all appreciate and love. So I'll stop there.
Next, we have Michelle Thaler, who was an addition, so this is great to have four people, so why don't you take your...
Okay, sure. My name is Michelle Thaler. I'm also at NASA. We got NASA represent. That's right. Yeah, we got fist bump. So actually, Eric and I work in the same place. I'm also at NASA headquarters, although this is my third NASA base. I've worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. And I'm an astrophysicist, and I have had so many different flavors of adventure. I'm going to try to break down some wonderfully different flavors of adventure. Certainly my career as an astronomer, if you were to ask me the favorite thing that just jumps out to mind is the travel. I never thought, growing up as a kid in rural Wisconsin, that I have been to every continent except Antarctica, and I'm working on that one. But not just that. I mean, when you know, I've been to 17,000 feet in Chile at the ALMA telescope, which is in the middle of the Atacama Desert. My trips have taken me, you know, to places like Cairo and Siberia, and all over Europe and Southern Africa. And so there's it's an amazing thing to think of the world as a familiar place, and I love that aspect of adventure. I tend not to do it in a very uncomfortable way. I mean, while I stay in perhaps inexpensive hotel accommodations, you know, I don't normally, I'm normally not camping. Although I am part of a group that Richard Branson curates, where he gets sort of leaders from all different industries together, and he had us all camping in the Panamanian jungle together, you know, trying to solve the world's problems. It was fun, actually. But you know, there's that aspect of adventure. But one of the things that I can't help but be so grateful for in my work at NASA is the adventure when you go along on the voyage of discovery. It may not be your human body is going somewhere, but I think a lot of you have been looking at the pictures that Cassini has been bringing back, right? Cassini is our mission to Saturn. And, you know, Cassini has been around Saturn for 15 years. That should blow your mind. We've had an observatory orbiting Saturn for 15 years, and it will we will deliberately crash the spacecraft in September because it's running out of its guidance fuel. And I'm going to be there with champagne and tears and ready to cry and cheer, you know, at JPL as Cassini finally bites the dust. But the beauty, if you have not seen images from Cassini, would you just please go back home and Google NASA Cassini and look at some of the images? We've had observatories. I mean, right now it's dancing right through the rings of Saturn. There was an image released yesterday of a moon we'd never seen before that looks like a giant space ravioli, about 20 miles across, made of ice and rock. And you know, just yesterday we had the press release about us finding an ocean, a liquid water ocean, on one of the moons of Saturn that is bubbling and fizzing with the chemistry that may indicate life. And people sort of... I've never gotten over this. I've never gotten used to this. The adventure of human exploration, even remotely, is something that inspires me to this day. And I know that there, most of my job, like Eric's, I mean, we're bureaucrats now. We go to meetings, we do budgets, you know, we vet a lot of documents. It's wonderful. But the thing, but the thing is, like, I remember the evening that the Mars Curiosity rover landed on Mars. And this is now going on almost 5 years ago. And it, I knew everything that had been skipped. We didn't have time to do this test. This test didn't come out very good, but we just had to go anyway. And you could never rehearse it because you were landing something in the gravity of Mars with no air, basically, 1% the atmosphere in this room. You can't rehearse that. There's different gravity, different atmosphere. This was a one-shot deal. And if you would have asked me to bet I think the thing would have crashed. I mean, I did not think this was going to work. I thought it was too complicated and too risky. But there I was that night of, I still remember it was 1:30 in the morning, and I was you know, up at NASA, you know, getting all the signals as this thing came down. And when they confirmed that it had touched down and we were getting signals and we were safe on Mars, I screamed uncontrollably and started jumping up and down. And I challenge all of you to have that experience where you actually lose control of your body. You are jumping and screaming before you know really what's going on. You know, despite the bureaucracy and despite the budgets and all of that, there are moments in my life of pure joy. And what I want this to lead to in terms of flavors of adventure is that I was a person that was told I didn't have what it took to be a scientist. I was a person that was told I wasn't the right personality to be a scientist, that I would never find a place in the world of science. I'm now deputy director of science at NASA for communications. But one of the things I really tried to incorporate into my life in the sense of adventure is move towards things that frighten you. You know, move towards things that scare you. And I, some people, I think, maybe have this natural instinct. I don't know if it was natural in me or not. But I've never been comfortable with myself, with my level of anxiety. I'm afraid of flying. I actually have panic attacks in airplanes. The next trip I'm going to make is to Bhutan, the Himalayas. I sometimes lose sleep over how am I going to get through that flight? How am I going to do that? And there's kind of the saying that sometimes the fear never goes away, so you're going to have to do it afraid. And the reward and the richness, and in some respects the pride in myself that I've had by just walking with the fear and inviting it in, you know, giving it a cup of hot chocolate and just sitting there with your fear, the fear isn't going away. And it's funny, you know, Eric and I were talking about politically incorrect things. I've noticed that my fear of flying has gotten better recently. And one of the things that I think actually led to this is me actually being honest with myself about my own emotions. You know, for the longest time, I wanted to be very thick-skinned, very in control, very much a person who doesn't show fear, who's always confident. And after years of, you know, dealing with sometimes aggressive and dominant people in my life and in my job, and, you know, and having sometimes difficulties in my personal life, I started to actually listen to my feelings, and I started to actually invite in the things that I'm afraid of or sad about or intimidated by. And instead of just pushing back that intimidation and that fear, welcoming it more. And wouldn't you know, the fear is lessening. There's another adventure. You know, there's the adventure of getting yourself to exotic destinations, which I've done. There's the adventure of being long on the inspiration of space travel. I'm 47 years old, and my emotions are changing. And for the first time, I'm listening to them. And somehow, that's making the fear better, and that may be my greatest adventure yet.
So this is Lena Gutschak, correct? And take it away. This is a pretty amazing panel.
Well, hi. And thank you for sharing all of these stories. That's really hard to follow. I have also thought a lot about adventure to prepare for this panel. And I wasn't clever enough to just go and look it up at the dictionary. But I was trying to figure out for myself, how do I define adventure? And I kind of came up with three things that make something an adventure for me. One is, it is something unknown. So it's a place or an event that, like a place I've never been to, or it's an event that I've never been through. Like, we all know, like, going to the supermarket is not something unknown. It's not adventurous, right? The second thing is, and I believe, John, you mentioned that also in the dictionary, is the uncertainty, that we do not know what awaits us. So we may be to a place that we know, but we do something completely different there, so we really don't know what's going to happen this time. And the third thing is the preparation, that you feel like you are not sure if you're prepared for this adventure. And that can be I was thinking, like, if you have already climbed Mount Everest and you're about to go to Japan for the very first time, it's an unknown place, and you want to climb Mount Fuji, you are probably pretty prepared for this. So adventure for me is when these three things come together. It's unknown to me, it's uncertain what the results will be, and I have no idea if I'm prepared for this. So I was trying to find some adventures of my past. Never been to the polar. But I was thinking, it's sometimes the things that we do for the very first time. When I was 16 years old, I decided to leave my hometown, leave my parents, and move to Berlin to go to circus school. It's a completely unknown place for me. I had never moved out of home. I had no idea what awaits me. I'm going to this school that is a former school of East Germany, just 10 years after the wall came down. I have no idea what the teachers will be like. I'm kind of feeling like moving into a new country, even though we're united already. And I had no idea if I was prepared enough for this. I mean, I trained the whole summer before we went to the school, and of course I trained many years before that, but I didn't know if I would make it through the first year. They make a cut after the first year, so I didn't know if I was prepared for that. So that felt adventurous back then. I was thinking of other stories where I went into the Indonesian rainforest and I went to see orangutans, and we were camping in the rainforest, and they had these kind of camping showers there where they collect rainwater and you can kind of use the water in the morning. And I had this encounter where I was showering in the morning and I heard a noise right a couple of feet next to me, and I turned off the water and I was freezing. And what I saw was like the orange back of a huge orangutan walking by me. And I was there naked in my shower. I felt like, ooh, okay, we're really like, this is nature. And this is probably something like, ooh, I know who's going to win. Like, whatever's happening, you know it's going to win. But the orangutan just looked at me for a second, looked away. I was just like, I hadn't walked away. So I was like, okay. So that felt adventurous at that moment, at least. And there's a couple of these stories where it was something unknown, uncertain. I didn't know if I'm prepared for it. But looking back at these things, looking back at these stories, they're really just that to me now. They're really just stories to me now. They don't really feel adventurous anymore. Maybe it's just because I went through it and I remember every single part of it. It's just like a chain of events that I went through and I came out of it. So I was really wondering, am I adventurous? And if I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking that kind of adventures kind of only exist in the future, because they can only be unknown and uncertain and you don't know what awaits you and if you're prepared, if they're in the future, not if you've already lived through them. I think I can only call myself adventurous if I keep on seeking for more adventures. If I just lie back now and I'm not never leaving my house, I can't really say I'm adventurous anymore. So why is adventure important? I think there's three different phases you go through when you are about to do an adventure. And I think the very first phase is actually making that decision to go on that adventure. And in just making that decision, I think you're already making a big step forward into your adventure. And it already feels adventurous to say yes to something that's unknown, uncertain, and you don't know if you're prepared for it. And I think all you can rely on is somehow your self-confidence. Like, I have no idea what the outcome will be, but I'm just going to say yes, and I'll just figure it out when we're there. The second phase for me is when you're in the event, when it's happening, and you just have to push through. And it's something that John talked about as well. You don't know what's awaiting you, and you have to make decisions. You have to trust your instincts. You have to be creative with all the new situations that you didn't plan for, that were unplanned. And I think even that comes back to the self-confidence. Like, I have to trust my guts. Okay, I just have to trust myself in this. The third phase for me in an adventure is, how do I reflect on it afterwards? So I live through all of this, and now what do I do with it? Like, what have I learned? And what I usually do is I'm trying to figure out what were the things that went well. What were things where I feel like I made the right decision, where I made a good decision? What were the moments where I could have done different decisions? I should have taken a different turn. Does anyone want to take the phone?
She got control of it.
I think.
Cool. And just to sum it all up, I think the last thought that I have after this debriefing, after an adventurous thing, is, okay, I've overcome all of these things. I didn't know what it's going to be like. And what's my next adventure? Like, with everything that I've learned, like, what do I jump to next? And it's a little bit the fear that you, Michelle, talked about. Like, the fear never goes away. It's not that you've done one thing where you didn't know where it's going and you went through this and you're like, yes, I know, now I conquer the world because I know everything and I know how to do this. Every single adventure still starts with the same thing, unknown, uncertain, I don't know if I'm prepared for it. But I think that every single adventure that you walk through will make you stronger and will make you believe more in yourself and trust your guts. Thank you.
Before we get to the questions from the audience, it will be submitting your questions on cards. So there's a couple different producers here to get your questions. But this panel would like to ask each other and talk amongst themselves about what they've just heard, share some stories before we get to your questions. So we have a few minutes.
Well, you kind of think it's pretty badass if somebody's card that he just gave me says John Houston Polar Explorer. It's like, oh, damn. I mean, you know, I want to. So are you in the circus? Is that? I didn't. Read, I want to hear more about that. I also want to hear more. Tell us some polar stories. Come on.
Well, polar stories. I feel a bit shy about the Polar Explorer moniker. It's a bit of a misnomer. To me, the true pioneers, true polar explorers, were the people who went 110 years ago and filled in the map of the Earth, or people who are down in deep ocean, true unknown to humans. But there's no term for mountain, like a mountaineer is pretty simple. There's no analogous term for long-distance polar expedition skier. So that's where I end up with polar explorer. We were in Ellesmere Island, is in far northeastern Canada, and it is an island as big as Great Britain, and less than 150 people live there. There's a small Inuit town on the southern coast of about 120 people. 300 miles north, maybe 350 miles away from that town, is a small, tiny weather station, about 10 people. And then there is a small military base, another 350 miles north on the north coast. Ellesmere Island is located directly west of northwestern Greenland. And it's a wild place. It's inhabited by polar bear, wolves, Arctic hare, and a lot of these wild animals have never encountered a human being. We traveled there in 2013, four people and four dogs. We were ski joring, which is where a dog and a person pull sleds in tandem. Sometimes the dog's out front, sometimes the dog and the skier are right next to each other. We traveled 65 days, about 600 miles or so, and we saw 65 different Arctic wolves. And often, we would pull into where we were setting up camp. And that's not often, but it happened a few times, and a small pack of wolves would just buzz us. Not as scary as an orangutan naked in the shower. But Those wolves have probably been following us all day long, and we are none the wiser. Or we would leave camp and head downwind, and 50 yards past our dogs, or 30 yards past our dogs, there would be wolf prints from the night before. And no one on our team knew a thing. We brought dogs to be a wildlife alarm as well for polar bear and wolf. But when the wind direction is the wind direction, the locals know how to use that. And it's uncanny being in a place like that where humans are the outsiders and where the local population try to kind of spies on you and figures out who you are and what you are. So I really love being on that edge. And I see expedition stories, and either as a childhood or today, or just adventure stories as like beacons of what's possible. And I think that in people's own lives, they don't have to do a major expedition or go to Tahiti. Well, going to Tahiti would be all right. But, you know, you don't have to do a major project to do an expedition. You can take an adventure every day if you want to. Go walk somewhere where you haven't walked before. Go without your iPhone and figure out how to get somewhere. I think that sort of mentality where you don't know what's going to happen next, but you know that you'll figure it out and you're going to have a good time along the way. There might be some road bumps. Is a good recipe for a small journey that can be a spice of life.
I think there's probably, I don't think we've really covered it, but there may be two different flavors of adventure. One which is more purposeful or discovery oriented, that adventure is a sort of a side issue or a byproduct of you're going out, scientists going on expeditions to just examine this or do that. And then there's a whole another flavor, which is the created adventure, where we're seeking simply to test ourselves against the environment, to do something that nobody's ever done before. And I think they're of a slightly different character. But they're not mutually exclusive either. They can be combined, weighted differently. But I think I don't think I've really ever set out to, as this, I'm setting out on an adventure. I mean, there was a purpose to do something, and the adventure just sort of came along for the ride.
I think we can kind of add a third one to that, because I think we're all talking about adventures that we choose to take.
Right.
But I am, and I can't really speak on that. But I'm curious if any of you have stories about it, of adventures that we didn't really choose to take, but that were kind of forced on us. I'm thinking of like refugees who need to from one day to the next flee their hometown, or things like this. I don't know if any of you have stories like that.
I feel like I may be becoming a refugee from Washington D.C.
Oh yeah, yeah. I guess it's not my personal experience. My family was World War refugees when they came to the United States. My mom was actually born in a concentration camp, and they were liberated by American GIs who I kept in touch with until they died. The last one only died a couple of years ago, and you know the thing is, at one point we actually sort of got a map out to see where all my baby mother and my grandmother had walked as they were forced all across Eastern Europe, and they'd walk clear across Europe. I mean, and how do you do that? You know, how do you survive something like that? And then, you know, it's funny because sometimes I've thought of my mom as being a bit cold and disapproving, and when you use the word self-confidence and you're saying it comes down to your self-confidence, I realize that I never use that word with myself. That I guess I could never quite live up to what they had to endure. And although they gave me a lot of freedom to pursue my own path, they didn't give me a lot of approval about it. But, you know, I think that the imbalance in myself and the imbalance in my life, I always thought, okay, I don't think I have what it takes to be a scientist, but I'm just going to keep trying until they either throw me out or I have a nervous breakdown. And the interesting thing is neither of those things happened. I think sometimes it's all very good to be balanced and have good mental health, and I'm not advocating being totally unbalanced. But
I kind of like the unbalance in myself. I think it's gotten me, it's almost like a little bit of a slope in my character that keeps me wanting to challenge myself, that keeps me wanting to say, what's the next adventure I'm going to be involved in? And then somehow you end up looking back, and I'm so glad that you, you know, even as young as you are, you already have this, and you say, that was actually my own self-confidence. I like that.
I like what, you have to tell me how to pronounce your name. Is it Lena or Lena?
Lena.
I like what Lena said about committing. Because I think that adventures aren't always, they're difficult. And I think that, at least myself, I go after adventures because I like what they do to me. I find them challenging. I find them fun. I like where they take me. I like the people I end up working with. But it's sometimes they are very, very difficult. There are human interactions that are a big challenge, and the outcomes are unknown. But I try to, since I chose to do this adventure, it's something I want to do. I try very hard with my teammates along to not complain about that, to embrace all aspects of that project and see it as part of the journey or part of the process, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And in some ways, marriage or a relationship is an adventure because life is changing and you have to work it out with that partner. And so unexpected adventures in my life, like we had twins, that was unexpected. They're 1 year old on Sunday.
Anything else? We have a couple questions, and we can keep going because I think this will touch on each of you. This is from a student. Younger generations in us, younger generations in us are getting less connected to adventure. Oh, in the U.S. are getting less connected to outdoor adventure. How do you change that? How do you make the outdoors cool?
Whoever decided the indoors was cool.
I think winter is pretty cool.
I'm not sure I agree with the premise that the young people today are spending less and less time outdoors. I mean, there has been this huge rise in things like extreme sports, which I think in some cases might have even been a sort of a counter reaction to very protective, you know, the idea that, you know, children all have to be very protected and bike helmets and everything's very safe and car seats. I mean, they're doing things like kite flying and kite jumping, you know, which is amazing to me that people can do that. It seems to me when I look at young people today, they are very adventurous. You know, I work with people that are you know, they're very young, but they're very comfortable traveling the world. They're very comfortable questioning norms. I mean, I think that yes, certainly people spend time with their gadgets and their electronica, but I mean, then to me, I think that is a very interesting thing. I mean, I really love being part of the Borg Collective. I mean, I like having my friends this close to me on my device. I like that connection. When I put that down these days and go camping or hiking and leave that behind, I really feel that lack. And I wonder what it's like for people that were born with this. I mean, this was a latter introduction to my life. That must be quite the adjustment. And I think something everyone should experience. But I'm not sure young people today are going out less.
I have a small passage in a book that can put some facts to that.
Okay.
So this book is by Florence Williams, who was a panelist. Did anybody see Florence?
Yep.
So she's totally awesome. She has a book called The Nature Fix, which I highly recommend you pick up over at Mackey, and it's doing very well. It came out in February. It's all about why nature makes us happier, healthier, and more creative. So on page 4, she writes, so we do things that we crave and make us tetchy, like check our phones, blank. Guess how many times the average person checks their phone per week?
Per week? Oh, no.
How many times the phone is picked up by that person? Per week. 1,500 times a week, while often neglecting to do things that bring us joy. Yes, we're busy. We've got responsibilities. But beyond that, we're experiencing a mass generational amnesia enabled by an urbanization and digital creep. American and British children today spend half as much time outdoors as their parents did. Instead, they spend up to 7 hours a day on screens, not including time in school. So I do think that the screen culture is an addictive thing that there is more and more research into, and there are rehabilitation facilities for people who are addicted to video games. It sounds funny, but it's totally true. And these people will drive themselves into mental illness because they are so fixated on that video game or that phone. And so I think an adventure can be for some people is putting that phone down and relying on human contact and their own intuition. And it's something that is very difficult to do for, I think, the current generation.
For me, I think a small adventure in eighth grade was key to my career, which was every eighth grader in our Orange County, California schools had to go to sea for a day on a small oceanographic vessel and do current meters and net tows and learn about the ocean. And I was lucky enough that my brother, who was in college, was the teaching assistant on board. And so my mother let me cut school all the time to go out on the boat. And so I was his little assistant, and it was awesome. So it motivated me to keep A's in all my classes in the eighth grade so that my mother would let me go. And it was the adventure that leads to an oceanography career. And there are a lot of other people in that county who had a similar experience with that. So I think the cost of it was well worth every penny the school district spent.